John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Nat Needham, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godars, Carl Marxer, and Ariel Boone. Happy birthday, Ariel. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for our video and audio podcasts and transcripts, and check us out on Roku and Facebook and Instagram. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time now is 8 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Limp Wrist. Live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. Limp Wrist, four unruly lewd queens playing hardcore call for all dykes, rough girls, sissy boys, trans folks, leather teos, fierce queens, punks, the non-defined, and the questioning, to come get loose at their only Northwest show. Also playing are Xylitol from Olympia and Portland's Labinden Toten and Petite. Again, that's Limp Wrist, live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Girl.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Americana singer-songwriter Libby Roderick, Saturday, March 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Libby Roderick is an internationally known environmental and peace activist and musician. This concert contributes toward building community through music. Again, that's Americana singer-songwriter Libby Roderick, Saturday, March 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Light shining out from our eyes, and the dreams resting deep in our souls.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs is a two-hour screening of Portland-related short documentaries produced by local independent filmmakers, including Mackenzie Blake, Outside the Frame, Sika Stanton, Donovan Smith, and more. The screening will be followed by an audience Q&A session. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. Minors allowed with parent or guardian. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up this morning on KBOO, Next Positively Revolting takes a break, and instead we present the Women's International News Gathering Service in an interview with Ninochka Roska, Filipino-American writer and organizer. At 9, it's Veterans Voice Radio. Northwest Veterans for Peace deal with matters of war and peace. At 10 on Valley Views is a conversation with Faith Reidenbach, co-founder of Showing Up for Racial Justice. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Project Censor discusses the Me Too campaign and how corporate media portrays sexual harassment and violence. And now it's the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today on Wings, transnational feminist Ninochka Roska.
Intersectionality is not a word for individual liberation. It is a word for collective liberation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Born and university educated in the Philippines, Ninochka Roska stood against the Marcos dictatorship, was imprisoned, moved to Hawaii in 1977, and became U.S. representative for the Philippine Left feminist organization Gabriela. With other Filipinos abroad, she developed the U.S. solidarity organization Gabriela Network, or GABNET, which has evolved into a broader transnational feminist organization called AFIRM, spelled AF numeral 3 IRM. Rosca is also a celebrated writer of fiction and commentaries. In August 2017, Ninochka Rosca spoke by phone from her home in New York to Megan Murphy, founder of the Canada-based multimedia outlet Feminist Current.
Ninochka Rosca, can you tell me about your early life? You know, I'm curious as to how you came to activism.
I was born and raised in the Philippines and got both a secular and Catholic education. You know, we're all Catholics in the Philippines, about 85%. So I think the only exceptional thing was when our family was extremely mixed blood, basically Spanish, Malayan, and Chinese. And then there was a huge crowd always in my family house. By crowd, I mean household help. And these people came from different regions and provinces of the country. And so they spoke different languages. We all spoke Tagalog, but they spoke, in addition to that, several other languages, their hometown language, etc., etc. And so I was exposed very early to the pleasures and the hazards of communication, you know, in different languages. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was one seminal incident when I was a kid. The domestics, the help, discovered I could read very early on, around five years old. And so a number of them couldn't. So they, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I think twice a week, they would ask me to read to them. They would buy the comics or the weekly fiction magazine, and they would surround me while I read. And it was a very beautiful thing, you know, in the garden, breeze blowing, flowers, trees, and then reading to a group of people. And from that I drew the rather erroneous conclusion that one could make money reading and writing, since the men and women of the neighborhood paid me, you know, they gave me 5 centavos, each of them gave me 5 centavos, and that was a lot of money for a kid. There, and then we had, my family had a very good library. I don't know why, since nobody read the books except me, and only because I was told, don't touch the books. So I'm like, why not? There must be something in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was growing up, and then I got to the university at a very young age and realized I did not know enough. And so I spent the whole summer reading, just reading, going through. I decided to read the entire literature section of the university library. I was kind of weird. So I started alphabetically. Those were the only exceptional, I think, things that happened when I was growing up, yeah.
And when did you first encounter the women's movement?
Oh, quite late, actually, quite late. I started as a political activist, a student activist, because the most exclusive organization at the university was the Writers' Club. And you could only go in, you know, if you were unanimously voted in. You know, nobody objected. And that's where all the leftists were. That's where I met he who would become the chairperson of the Communist Party of the Philippines. And so we started learning all of this stuff. Actually, I only got to women and feminism in 1986, which is quite late in my development. When I was able to return home and I wrote a piece on the women's movement in the Philippines for Ms. Magazine. Yeah, they used it as a cover story.
You were a political prisoner under the government of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. I wonder if you can tell me about that. Why were you imprisoned and what was that experience like?
Whoa. In 1972, he declared martial law, and then he had all the media offices, television, you know, newspaper, everything closed. And about 300 men and women of the media arrested. I was, this was what I was told. Of the around 5,000 in the list of people to be arrested, my number had only 2 digits. So I was in the first 100 people listed, primarily because they wanted to control reportage and so on. I spent 6 months in prison. They call it a detention camp, but it's actually a prison inside the military camp. And it was most unpleasant, most uncomfortable, and very, you know, it's like every minute of the day you are in danger. You live in constant tension. I remember that in those 6 months, my sleep was so light. I don't think I even had a single dream. You know, maybe I did, but it didn't make it to my conscious mind, which is most unusual for me because I dream every night. You know, as a writer, my subconscious is always working. And the slightest noise would wake me up. Almost all of us were tortured physically. Some were sexually abused. There was constant psychological harassment and torture. Yeah, 6 months. Yeah.
And do you worry that we're headed in that direction, or not we? I'm in Canada, but you're in the U.S., of course. Do you worry that the U.S. is headed in that direction?
Very much so, very much so. Especially with the recent happenings in Charlottesville, in Virginia, which is very near New York City where I am. It's only four or five hours away by car. And it's so ironic that the president who has encouraged this was actually born and raised in New York City, which we always pride ourselves in characterizing as a most cosmopolitan, most liberal city. You know, we pass all these laws, removing restrictions on people. But there is an atmosphere of fear, outrage, and helplessness. What does one do? You know, if you're just a woman of color, you know, it's like the everyday sexism and racism we live under, which is the what we call the microaggressions of racism and sexism, have become macroaggressions and really dangerous and threatens everything and all the hours of your day.
Now, you were the founder and first national chair of GABNET, which is a U.S.-based organization supporting the Philippine women's movement, which has since evolved into a firm. Why was it so important to form a specifically U.S. Philippines Women's Solidarity Network?
The Our rationale, well, the center of attention at the time in the Philippines was the U.S. military bases. People don't know, but at the time the U.S. kept its largest military bases in the Philippines, and actually under the agreement we were supposed to host 22 military bases. You know, for a small country, that is a huge imposition. And these bases, the Clark Air Force Base and Subic Naval Base, these bases were surrounded by a very dense community, or I don't know if you can call it a community, but a very, very dense area of strip clubs, nightclubs, brothel houses, hotels, and this was serving as magnets, drawing in women from the countryside who did not actually understand what they were getting into, or they were being trafficked from the rural areas to Angeles City and Olongapo City. Those two cities, they were called sin cities. And then there was the issue of drugs, and then the beatings, and there were several women who were murdered. One of them was just, well, not a woman, a girl, a kid, you know. She was, I think, 12 or 13 years old, and she died from an infection because a Marine customer had used a vibrator on her, and it broke off and left pieces in her vaginal canal, and she developed blood poisoning. So this was the biggest question at the time, because the treaty between the United States and the Philippines on this basis was coming to an end, and there were those who wanted to extend it. Of course, the U.S. wanted to extend it, but the Philippines, we wanted the treaty ended and the bases gone. And so there was a very strong women's movement in the Philippines, but it needed international exposure. So I was asked if I would consider helping. So I did.
Great.
And that changed my life completely.
Mm-hmm.
On Wings, you're listening to Ninochka Roska, a founder of the transnational feminist organization known as AFIRM, spelled AF3IRM. The interviewer is Megan Murphy of Feminist Current.
Really? You know, I was an activist from my teenage years, but I've always felt like I didn't come from the class I was advocating for, you know, so there was always a kind of detachment in, you know, when I look at the work. But with the women's movement, suddenly things which I couldn't understand before became very clear. It was personal.
Mm-hmm. And you're also, you're the international spokesperson for AFIRM's Purple Rose campaign, which deals specifically with the trafficking of Filipino women. What is the situation with trafficking in the Philippines today?
It's very difficult to make a distinction between trafficking and prostitution in the Philippines. It's connected to the tourist industry, of course, and it's connected to cyber sex, the cyber sex industry, which centers around the use of children. We are, I hate to use the word Mecca, but we are one of the centers for cyber child prostitution, you know. The last time I was in Cebu, which is an island in central Mindanao, Visayas. The women, they were telling me about how children were used for this, and the customers were mostly Australian, German, people in Europe, American. And sometimes the customer would make an arrangement to come and visit. And that's it. That child is raped, basically. Yeah. So it's difficult to make that distinction. Now, tourism provides roughly 11% of the gross income of the Philippines. So it's a very, very big section of the economy.
And, you know, I'm interested to learn more about the women's movement in the Philippines. What are some key differences between the women's movement in the Philippines and the women's movement in North America? And are there things that Western feminists could learn from Filipino feminists?
This is the situation. It's like this. We had the reproductive health law, which only provides for contraception for the very poor. And that was fought over for 17 years. It was a very mild law. No abortion, no nothing, just contraception. But it couldn't pass Congress for 17 years. It's an indicator of the status of women in the Philippines. Yeah. It's a Catholic country, and it's very much a country. Yeah. There are eternal discussions about whether a man saying "Hi, babe" to you in the street is catcalling or he's just being friendly. It's ridiculous. Things that we accept as, you know, this is really an imposition on a woman in Western countries. These are just par for the course of the day for a woman in the Philippines. And then we have this issue with the definition, the legal definition of statutory rape, which is set at the age of 11, which by implication makes the age of consent 12 years old.
Jeez.
Yeah, so in the United States, there is a big difference with the women's movement here. We are also divided, but based largely on ethnicity and color. And it's very hard to cross over, to have a mixed ethnic constituency. But I think we're trying to resolve that now. Affirm is doing that. And there are coalitions all over the place because women are coming to realize that there is no one ethnic community that can carry the changes that we need to effect in the United States.
On that note, the term intersectionality has become really commonplace these days.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like to the point where it's become like a buzzword even, and it's used all the time online, and it's used often by white people to sort of demonstrate politically correct politics, I would say, you know, what's sometimes called virtue signaling. But I'm concerned that many people who do label themselves intersectional in quotations don't really understand what that term means. What does intersectionality mean to you?
Well, it's not simply difference, which is how, by and large, you know, it's vulgar interpretation. I'm different, therefore I'm intersectional. No, that's not it. Ironically, we were the first to like come out and say we are for both transnational and intersectional feminism. And actually, Kimberly Crenshaw marched with us, I think about 3 years ago. during the Million People's March of Black Lives Matter. And we were the only delegation, we and Sister Circle Collective, we were the only delegation who carried the names and photographs of all the black women killed by the police. And so Kimberly was there, and she was marching with us and some other people. And from that came the movement to Say Her Name, the campaign Say Her Name, yeah. But the thing was, intersectionality is a way of analysis. It's a method of analysis. It is a theory of power and power relations, which seldom, this concept seldom appears, yeah, in the rather casual way people use the term. For us, it is understanding our place as a nodal point of interlocking systems of oppression. We call it the trihelix DNA of exploitation in an advanced capitalist society. And this is like race, gender, and class. And we very seldom ever take a position without considering those three aspects. And intersectionality is not a word for individual liberation. It is a word for collective liberation. I think this is what a lot of white women do not understand, white people in the United States, you know, do not understand. They think intersectionality expresses itself in individualism. It's not. It's a collective. It's a coming together of one's individual position and collective position in society. It's actually locating yourself in the collective, in understanding the collective, which is enduring the same interlocking systems of oppression. So I know people have said you are Western feminists, etc., etc. Well, no, we're not. We look at everything. We look at the economics of it. We look at the politics of it. We look at the social aspect. We try to be very comprehensive. Now, the thing with both transnational feminism and intersectional feminism, these were developed in academia and by academics. Mohanty developed transnational feminism and Kimberly Crenshaw intersectional feminism, although based on actual lived experience. So our task now is to use this as guides, but only as guides in our action on the ground, and then to discard, accept, change aspects and parts of these two perspectives depending on what we experience in our work organizing, educating, and mobilizing women.
One of the things I find really frustrating about Western liberal feminism is its lack of understanding or interest in class and the way that capitalism and patriarchy work together to keep women vulnerable and oppressed. You know, the kind of feminism that we hear about in mainstream media especially is really focused on what celebrities have to say about so-called feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so great about Affirm is that you have such a strong analysis of how these various systems of power intersect. And those who talk about intersectionality in the U.S. often still don't criticize pop culture and mainstream media and the sex trade and the beauty industry and all these things totally rooted in capitalism and corporatism. How do you see things like capitalism, colonialism, imperialism contributing to women's oppression in the real world? You know, how should we be looking at feminism and women's rights, mm-hmm, within those contexts?
Well, a firm has a requirement, a very strict requirement about study. So we study, and so we don't stop with capitalism. You know, we actually start with the rise of class. And I think this is what is lacking in the public's understanding of what feminism is and how women's oppression is related to the concepts of private property and class evolution, you know, the evolution of class. We have a four-hour discussion on the creation of patriarchy by Lerner. You know, the whole book is required reading. So we at least understand how it is that in every class society, women are oppressed. I think that's the very fundamental thing that we need to understand first of all. Because capitalism does not exist historically, independent of its historical evolution. And so it carries forward all of the traditions and concepts which enabled class to develop and survive. So that's one thing, that's the first. And then second, we are women of color. We call ourselves transnational women because we come from lands and cultures which had experienced colonialism and which are now experiencing imperialism. With its use of corruption and the local oligarchy to maintain its power over these lands, you know.
That book Roska mentioned as important to study is The Creation of Patriarchy by historian Gerda Lerner.
When someone asked me what I thought about the publicly finally listening, and not just listening, but with compassion and believing our stories, they asked me what my response was to this. And to be honest, my response was, it's about goddamn time.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
They're cheering in solidarity. My name is Ivy Kitcho, and I am the national chairperson of AFFIRM, an all-volunteer, transnational feminist, anti-imperialist organization of women of color and of survivors. I am here in front of you, quite literally, because my activist organizing has saved my life. I was a victim of child sexual abuse starting at the age of 2, a victim of rape at the age of 15 by someone I knew, not necessarily a rich, powerful public predator, and a victim of intimate partner physical violence as an adult, not to mention all the other forms of structural violence that come with being a woman of color, specifically an Asian Pacific Islander, daughter of Filipino immigrant parents, and growing up in poor working class neighborhoods in a country that has intentionally stacked the odds against me. As a survivor, there have been many times that I wanted to give up, from the exhausting daily demeaning thoughts that prevent you from doing simple tasks like getting out of bed, to the terrifying panic attacks from flashbacks, to the nightly jaw clenching and hip tightness because our body parts hold sadness, not just from today, but generations past. But sisters, I am here today to tell you that because of my 13 years of organizing in AFFIRM, AFFIRM has provided me the one thing that pushes me forward, the one thing that gets me up every single day when I have suicidal thoughts, the one thing that pushes me to keep on track, and that is hope. We in Affirm are here to tell all the women of color, black, brown, yellow, indigenous, trans women, each and every woman of color like me, that we see you. This is our commitment to you. We will do what our ancestors had done and taught us for centuries. We will get back up every time with even more seething rage. We will resist every twisted tactic they may throw at us, and we will fight with every last drop of strength we have left until genuine liberation is ours. The hashtag MeToo movement exposes on a mainstream level what has been happening to women, particularly women of color, for centuries. 4,500 years ago, patriarchy was created when we women became the first form of property. Rape culture didn't just come out of nowhere. It was born out of what we in Affirm call the perceived patriarchal entitlement to women's bodies. For centuries, access to women of color's bodies in particular has been expected. And this belief has been given life through colonization when our bodies and land were ravished. Through capitalism, when our bodies became commodified for prostitution. Through imperialism and war and military, when we were sold on a large scale for what has become the global sex trade. From the online mail order bride system, to institutionalized red light districts, to the attempts at legalizing prostitution. Sisters, while this has been happening to us for all this time, what Trump, what those sexists, what those misogynists, what those fascists who uphold patriarchy seem to forget is that we are still here and we are not going anywhere. When someone asked me what I thought about the publicly finally listening, and not just listening, but with compassion and believing our stories, they asked me what my response was to this. And to be honest, my response was, it's about goddamn time. And what we talk about, when we talk about sexual assault and rape, we have to talk about it as a way to dehumanize in order to amass power and control. This is not about sex addiction. This is about amassing power and control over women and our communities that we oversee. Now is the time that we see how these recent acts of terror are all connected. It is no coincidence that from Charlottesville to Las Vegas to Texas, the common denominator is and has been domestic violence. We are living in an era of fascism that relies on the subjugation of women. To end violence on our communities, we must end violence against women. Now is the time that when we talk about sexual harassment of rich, famous actresses in Hollywood, we also talk about the marginalized voices, including Native Americans who've experienced sexual assault at more than double than any other population. We must talk about the sexual assault and murder of our homeless trans sisters, not just by the everyday person, but by killer cops who are hired to protect us when in fact they inflict the violence on our people, particularly our black community. Now is the time that we not only talk about assault of white collar professionals, but that we center the experience of undocumented women, Filipina domestic workers who are raped by their captive employers, of immigrant women from Mexico who get sexually assaulted several times en route as they cross the border. That we talk about the experience of our Middle Eastern sisters, also known as Southwest Asia, North Africa sisters, who face Islamophobia on top of the sexual assault. It's time that we talk about the trafficked, prostituted Asian women in massage parlors who are sexually exploited and must be decriminalized while stopping the legislation and legalization of a system predicated on the sale of rape. Now is the time that we talk about accountability and what that is and what that looked like. And while simultaneously demanding accountability of individuals who perpetuate the hate and the violence, such as resignation, such as apologies, we must also demand that these systems that breed violence and patriarchy also be dismantled, including ICE, including the prisons, including Trump, who is in office. Sisters, today I challenge you to practice a feminism that is revolutionary. Let us go beyond building a sisterhood rooted in suffering and build a sisterhood rooted in societal transformation. Let us continue to share our stories to demand justice and accountability, but let us also actively work on dismantling the structures and the culture of rape that breeds this violence so that future generations will not only not know rape, will not only not know sexual assault, but they will never know the concept of violence against our people. Most importantly, let us be bold in our dreaming of liberation and reimagine what justice could look like, taste like, feel like. Perhaps it isn't just demanding individual accountability in Hollywood. Perhaps it is ensuring marginalized women of color hold positions in every power level in the film and industry. Perhaps it isn't just demanding resignation of those who assault in academia, but it is demanding that the type of material taught in schools and universities also include exercises to unlearn patriarchy. Perhaps it isn't just electing more marginalized women and peoples into office, it is changing how those offices function, giving more power to the people. Sisters, we are our target for one reason and one reason alone. Because they fear our collective power and growing movement. We are still here and we are not going anywhere. And what we in Affirm say, a woman's place is not in the home. It's not in the kitchen. It's not in the bedroom. A woman's place is here in the streets at the helm of the struggle for liberation of all people. Now I want you to chant with me so that all of Hollywood and all the tourists can hear us. When women and children are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. When women and children are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
Thank you.
That was Ivy Kitcho, the national chair of Affirm, speaking at the Me Too Survivors March in Hollywood on Sunday, November 12, 2017. Affirm, spelled AF numeral 3 IRM, grew out of a transnational solidarity organization of Filipinas in the U.S. Last week on Wings, you heard the original organizer, Ninochka Roska, describe Affirm as both transnational and intersectional, meaning it works against three forces oppressing women of color: race, class, and patriarchy.
For us, it is understanding our place as a nodal point of interlocking systems of oppression, race, gender, and class.
Here is the remainder of Ninochka Roska's interview with Megan Murphy of FeministCurrent.com.
On a daily basis, colonialism, capitalism, and imperialism, these are lived realities for women of color in this country. And so we understand that. But I know we like to talk about the weaknesses of the liberal feminism and what we call white feminism and so on. But I'm great friends with Gloria Steinem. And even she would say, it's not a question of getting a bigger slice of the pie, but rather baking a whole new pie altogether. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's impossible. You cannot attain gender equality where there are class and race divisions. That's why we say interlocking systems of oppression. Now, this kind of blindness is conversely reflected in the left when they talk about class and nothing but class and do not see the other systems that keep people marginalized and exploited. So those are the things. I think In the United States, class is very rarely used in political analysis because, you know, the slogan is out of the many, one. But if you do class analysis, you divide. You say out of the one, many.
In the wake of Donald Trump's win, some leftists have argued for inclusivity and unity, and, you know, which are nice ideas. And certainly, you know, if we're going to fight these incredible powers, we need to have solidarity and work together. But considering the deep divisions and conflicts among leftists and between leftists and feminists, do you think those goals are even possible or worthwhile? You know, how could we possibly accomplish that?
I do not know. We're trying, really. We're trying so very hard. And it's difficult. It's very difficult. We have a multi-ethnic constituency. And the community needs of our constituency are sometimes different and sometimes, you know, the same. But the expression of those needs, you have to navigate the difference in the expressions of those needs, how they are brought forward, you know, by the women of specific communities. It's hard, I must admit. But I think we should do, this is my view, personal, we should do what guerrillas do. Guerrillas are small formations deeply rooted in towns and villages, but when they have to attack a major formation, they come together. And then afterwards, they go back to being their own formations in their own locations. And I think that's what we should do politically, you know, come together to address macro issues, but disperse when it comes to micro issues. It's just a tactical theory that I'm thinking of. I don't know if it will work.
What do you think, what are some other concrete things that you think leftists and feminists should be doing right now and what they should be focusing on right now to counter the racism, misogyny, the neo-fascism supported by the Trump presidency?
I think what is seriously lacking is the link between racism and sexism. I do not see it, you know. They have already noted that all of these white men who march, the neo-Nazi formations, these are actually middle-class white males, okay? So we understand the class aspect to this issue. We understand the racism embedded in the issue, but the sexism has not surfaced. I think it's very telling that the first death in this growing confrontation is that of a woman, and we should really take that to heart, you know. And this is a woman who was actually working as a paralegal, meaning helping those who are in conflict with the justice system in this country.
The woman Ninochka Roska refers to here is Heather Heyer, who died when a car rammed into a group of people protesting against a Torchlight Unite the Right rally held in Charlottesville, Virginia, August 12, 2017. Roska was speaking to Megan Murphy shortly after this event. Roska is a founder of the transnational feminist organization AFFIRM.
AFFIRM recently advocated for what the organization calls a return to the foundational ideas of American feminism, concepts and wisdom drawn from tribal societies, particularly the Iroquois. What does that mean? Like, what are those foundational ideas? Where do they come from?
I think because I'm Filipina, I'm kind of fatalist. So this started about, I think, almost 4 years ago when Sylvia McAdam of Idle No More came to New York, and we hosted her public lecture. And this was so fascinating for us because we were at the time studying socialist economic formation, and we realized that so far the extant model uses capitalist production organization for socialism. And we saw this in the USSR, and we saw this in China, and we saw the results. If you want to create socialist values in a socialist way of life, well, how do you organize your production so that it reflects those values? That was the main question. And so we started studying tribal societies because we were curious as to how gender and not having private ownership of the means of production come together to create a viable society that is not exploitative of women. We're still studying it. And then we realized that the history of the United States began actually with the same curiosity on the part of the pioneers of the women's movement here. That was the first. And the second was we got tired of being told we are being influenced by Western feminism or that feminism is from the West. Oh my goodness, I mean, like, I'm Filipina. 1907 we had Asociacion Feministas de las Filipinas, you know, 1907. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The women had been struggling since the beginning of time. We may not have called ourselves feminists, but women have been fighting for rights, social, political, and economic. So we're still studying, and we hope to deepen our learning. Today, actually, I was very happy to have received confirmation that Pura Fe is coming to our summit. She is a very well-known singer, performer, First Nations. She lives in Saskatchewan. And she will be speaking on women in the tribal culture. She just launched a new project called the Ulali Project. This is a quartet of female singers singing a cappella all the native songs of North America, I mean Canada and the United States. And they are working on water songs, which I thought was quite fascinating. I mean, in contrast to the constant, you know, product, cultural products of capital and imperialism, which is always about sex, money, woman, blah, 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 you know. And then there are all these traditions about water, land, soil, and so on. Every 2 years, we have a summit. And there are always two aspects to the summit. One is public and one is private. The private one involves all the members, or at least the leadership of the various chapters of AFIRM, meet and lay out the direction, programs, you know, actions for the next 2 years. So we're doing that, the private one. And then the public conference is actually launching our new theoretical thrust, you know, and also gathering information from those who will attend on how to deal with the current situation, because this is really a very bad situation we're in now. So one of the things we're going to tackle at the summit is the issue of prostitution, because we come from countries where there are huge sex industries, you know, as a result of colonialism, occupation, and imperialism. I know this is a very contentious subject.
Yeah, it is. Which is surprising, I guess, that that would be such a contentious subject within feminism, because the sex trade is something that seems like an obvious thing to oppose as a political movement that is opposed to exploitation, to misogyny, to racism.
The liberation of sexuality is what comprises feminism. But nobody looks at what that liberation entails or how it is defined under capital. You mentioned the cosmetic industry and so on and blah, blah, blah. All of these are like accessories to the major contention that men have a right to have sexual access on the bodies of the female, the young, the poor, the vulnerable, the powerless, basically. See, it's the coercive demand that we use a kind of playboy philosophy to define feminism. And so this is one of the things that we really have to study, not only study, but oppose. Our position is very clear. We are for the decriminalization of those who practice prostitution, but we are for the criminalization of those who do the business of prostitution, meaning where the money is. You know, people who profit, who benefit from the sale of bodies. It is a very contentious issue because we understand that there are very poor sections who have to resort to this, you know, to survive. They call it survival prostitution, for instance, and I say all prostitution is survival prostitution, not only economically, but sometimes spiritually. And
I totally agree with you. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for all your incredible work. And I learned so much from Affirm's work also. So I'm really grateful. And I know that a lot of women are as well.
Thank you. I hope we just hope to contribute a little bit, you know, whatever we can to the women's movement. We're quite aware that the movement is huge and vast, and we're only a very small part of it. But we will work to add as much as we can.
I've been meaning to interview for you for a long time, so I'm glad that we finally got around to it.
Thank you. I'm very flattered. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You just heard an interview with feminist activist and prolific writer Ninochka Roska. For more on her work, visit ninochkaroska.com. And to learn more about Affirm, visit Affirm, that's AF3IRM.org. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current.
That interview with Affirm founder Ninochka Roska first appeared on FeministCurrent.com in August of 2017. In addition to being an organizer, Roska is a celebrated writer of fiction and nonfiction. Her books include Endgame, State of War, The Monsoon Collection, and Twice Blessed. You also heard the national chair of Affirm, Ivy Kitcho, speaking at the Me Too Survivors March in Hollywood on Sunday, November 12, 2017. Here she is again.
Now I want you to chat with me so that all of Hollywood and all the tourists can hear us. When women and children are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. When women and children are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
What do we do? What do we do? Thank you.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our new searchable website, wingsradio.org. Thank you to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Mindy Rann, Michelle Schuler, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are about to cross the border.
Coming up on A Different Nature, it's a preview of this year's March Music Moderne, profiling three free concerts happening at the Community Music Center. Tombeau de Claude Debussy commemorates the passing 100 years ago this month of one of the 20th century's most influential composers. I'm Andy Hosh. Join me along with March Music Moderne's Bob Priest and composers Jeff Winslow and Jennifer Wright on A Different Nature, Monday, March 19th from 8 to 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet this month on March 22nd at